You're listening to Coloring Outside the Memos with Dr. Tiffany Monique Quash and me, Dr. Lizzie Bartelt, a podcast about all things qualitative research. Thanks for listening and enjoy this episode. And welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Coloring Outside the Memos. I am Dr. Tiffany. I'm here with
Dr. Lizzie.
And this week, this week is a very, very special week because we are having a week of talking about a book, and we're going to get into that in a minute, but just a quick reminder to follow us on Twitter at @COTM_POD or email us at COTMpod@gmail.com. We love to get responses from you, our audience and our family members, about what's going on in your world. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Lizzie. So Dr. Lizzie, tell me, what are we reading this week?
This week? I'm so excited, y'all. This is our very first book club. Book club! Dear listeners, you have no idea how excited I am. I love book clubs. I've been in a lot of them over the years. Dr. Tiffany and I were talking just before we got on about how much of a reader I am. Even in grad school, we would go out for drinks and she would come up and I'd be like sitting and pawing through a book. Do you remember that?
I do. Do I remember that or do I remember the alcohol? Which one?
I mean, probably both, but
probably both.
Anyway, we're so excited for a whole new thing for y'all. We are reading, and I'm holding up the book like you all can see me. You can't. It's fine. Weapons of Math Destruction, M-A-T-H. Weapons of M-A-T-H Destruction. And I am spelling that out because, dear listener, if you are old like me, like Dr. Tiffany, we remember MASS as a big thing, weapons of MASS destruction, and weapons of MATH destruction are totally different, but also destructive. So we'll talk about it. We'll get into it. It is written by Kathy O'Neill. The subtitle of this book is How Big Data Increases Inequality and Threatens Democracy.
I am so excited about this. I'm beyond excited because I am not, like, looking at this, it's like, wait, is this a quant book? Like, I'm not gonna lie. I was like, is this a quant book? Are we talking about a quant book on a qual podcast? What is going on? So Dr. Lizzie, take me.
Okay. I got my backpack. Before we get into the backpack, let me tell you this quick story because you're going to get a hoot out of this. I didn't tell you this yet. I've been saving it until we talked about this. So a couple of weeks ago, I went on my trip to Napa and I was sitting in the Detroit airport having a glass of wine on a layover and I'm reading this book in the airport bar and I'm holding it up like this and I'm drinking and I'm like eating my dinner and I'm reading the book and all of a sudden the bartender comes up to me and is like, are you one of those like people who love numbers? What is that book you are reading? And I start laughing and I'm like,
one of those people.
She was like, I called you friend when you came up here. I might have to revoke that. And I was like, no, hold on now. And so then we had a back and forth about it for quite a long time. And she was like, oh, you're one of the good ones. And as I got up to leave for my plane, she was like, one. Keep doing the good work, break down data. And I was like, I got you.
Oh, I love it. I absolutely positively love it. Okay. So readers and listeners out there, the next time you are at a bar, make sure you bring this book with you because who knows what will happen to you. You may just get a free drink. Who knows? And you'll make a new friend along the way.
Conversations with bartenders. It's just fun. Everyone's going to think we're like huge drinkers now.
I know, right? Right. I mean, you know, that's what we need to have is a bottle of wine with our faces on it, talking about qualitative and like, maybe it's the logo for Coloring Outside the Memos and be like,
a wine of the day,
a wine of the day with the book. Oh my goodness.
So if I was going,
I've got my backpack.
Right. And if you want a wine to read with this book, I'm going to recommend a Tempranillo because that is a nice, strong, sassy wine and it goes well with this book.
Oh, and we have to tell listeners that you are a red wine person.
I really am.
You are a red wine person. So I guess we're going to have a new trend, book with wine. There you go.
Maybe that'll be the thing with the book club books. Anyway, yes. Let's move on before we've lost everyone in our divulsions. So this book, Put On Your Backpacks, we're going to embark on a journey about deconstructing big data. So this book, how did I find it? Because I always like to tell people how I find books because there's usually a good story with really good reads. And this one I found on a Twitter listicle of somebody posting, what is the most influential book you've ever read in your life? And I was reading through them and I was like, yep. Wait, I haven't read that one. And then I kept scrolling and I was like, it came up again. And I kept scrolling, it came up again. And it kept scrolling, came up again. And I was like, every other one that kept coming up was like Kindred, Beloved, Bluest Eye, you know, like all of these that we were literally talking about before this that I've read over, you know, multiple times. And I was like, yeah, those are influential books. And then I was like, what is a nonfiction book doing on this list? And why does everyone keep saying it? Twitter is not my go-to for book recommendations, but sometimes it works out. So here we are.
Interesting. I love this. Okay. Continue.
So this book is written by a former academic who left higher ed because of the politics of higher ed. She really doesn't go into that. Dr. O'Neill does not. Is it Dr. O'Neill? Kathy O'Neill does not go into that. But she does talk about leaving higher ed, leaving a tenure track position in biostatistics and going into hedge fund management. And then the housing crash happened. What a time to leave higher ed. Gave me the fear of death as I was reading this. I was like, don't leave higher ed. The housing crash will happen in your new industry. Mm-mm. Dear listener, you never know what the future will hold.
Wow.
I mean,
this
right?
Is the worst. I'm sitting here thinking that is the worst time to leave higher ed.
I know, but who could have guessed, right? She was there for 6 months and then the housing crash happened. And like mm-hmm. She's in the investment hedge fund stuff and was like, well, I might not have a job. What do I do now?
Then what happened? Now I'm like, then what happened? Like, what happens to her?
So then
our dear Kathy.
Dear Kathy then starts blogging about how problematic math formulas can be, joins Occupy Wall Street, and I know, and does some pretty high up work for them and talking about things that they're not talking about and that they should be talking about, and then goes on to work at several other places and do some really cool stuff and write this book. So turns out she did fine for herself. I don't know where she is now. Actually, I didn't look that up before this podcast, probably should have, but, we'll post an update on that. I don't know where she's been since 2017, which was the last revision of this book, but wow, this is what she does. So in this book, she starts talking to us about weapons of MATH destruction. And I'm going to keep spelling that out every time just because I don't want you to hear M-A-S-S. And I think it's really hard to enunciate that difference. So I'm going to keep spelling it out. I hope that's not too annoying.
I appreciate that.
Right. Because otherwise it's confusing.
Yeah.
So she starts by saying, walking us through this, what is going on with data? So if I were to say to you, Dr. Tiffany, what is the biggest problem you see in our society in the United States? What might you tell me?
In the United States, other than the Electoral College.
Yep, that's one of them.
Gosh. Electoral College, I mean, hate crime. I mean, the list goes on. Rights for marginalized people. Just equal opportunity, money. Oh my gosh, money, the lack thereof. Food insecurity. There's just so many.
And at the root of all of those, do you think there's one system driving it?
Capitalism.
Right? Like,
evil.
Yeah. And I feel like our generation, that's our go-to response, right? It was capitalism all along. It's which is a phrase from the podcast You're Wrong About. They use that all the time. Credit where credit is due. I'm not stealing that phrase without a proper citation, right?
Yes. Thank you, Dr. Lizzie.
So we talk about that all the time. We all came about at a time of young adulthood when Occupy Wall Street was a really burgeoning thing, right? And we all learned that lesson hard and fast. Some of us will say racism is the biggest driver, and some people will say, no, it's capitalism. And some people will say, no, it's the combination of the two. And I'm not here to solve that debate for you, but Kathy will tell us throughout this book that it's not just capitalism, it's not just racism, but actually the root of all of this is big data. And
wait, what?
I know.
Big data is the root of all of this. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but continue.
Right, though? Like,
it kind of reminds me of, no, go ahead. I don't want to interrupt. Go ahead.
Okay. Save it though. Make a note so that we can come back.
I'll save it.
All right. So what the entire synthesis, the entire conclusion of this book is that these big data points are run by computer-based learning. You might have heard that phrase before, or machine learning. It's another common phrase that gets tossed out. Sometimes, like when we're talking about, I have a lot of friends who I'll talk about, oh, well, the algorithm on the social media site or the dating site connected me with so-and-so. We all kind of sort of know that there are all of these data systems outside of our personal control that are influencing our lives, right? Oh, I was shopping in Target the other day and I stopped at the baby area because I was buying a present for a friend's baby shower. And then all of a sudden I got baby ads flooding my, you know, whatever I was doing on my phone for the next 5 days. Or I clicked on this link and then I got emails about whatever this one thing was that I did a Google search for. We all know that big data is influencing our lives. But until I read this book, I had no idea how much of the systems that I hate and the things that I've complained about for years are actually due to problematic math formulas and problematic understandings of big data and machine learning. So, are you ready for this journey?
I'm ready.
I know, right? Because you're already like, what is happening?
Yeah, it's pretty much.
Huge. It is. Okay. So we start on this journey with understanding education. So if I were to say to you, big problems in higher ed, I've talked to you about this before, I'm going to guess, can take a hunch that you would say loans are one of the biggest problem with higher ed.
I would say loans are the biggest problems. And if there's anybody out there who is listening that wants to pay my student loans, you can definitely contact me and Dr. Lizzie. Not that I want to say that Dr. Lizzie doesn't have student loans to pay for, but definitely you can contact both of us through the Gmail.
Direct them to Dr. Tiffany first. I mean, I've got them. I'm not saying I don't have them, but I don't have as much as you do.
This is true. So yeah, student loans. Yes. If we could get rid of student loans, that would make my life I would just be a very happy camper.
It would be amazing, right? And I this is a really important thing. And she talks about why we have student loan rates the way we do. She breaks all of that down based on the formulas. And so essentially the way that these loans work is that you do a Google search for going back to school as an adult. Innocent, simple Google search, right? What happens on the back end of that Google search is there are a bunch of people that are scooping up that data of what, who's Google searching for what. They're putting it into a formula and saying, if people search for going back to school as an adult, plus have searched for coupons in the past, plus have searched for childcare in the past, then what we can do is we can send them a bunch of information on high interest loans, and we'll tell them, we'll say in the title that these, you can go back to college for free or low cost. And both of us, our faces are like horror because we know that's not true. And so they're getting 10, 15% loans, right? They're getting these really predatory loans, but they're being sold to them as college is free or almost free based on these loans. And they're starting to be some accountability for that, right? In the Biden administration, we know that some of that has started to be equaled out, but a lot of it hasn't. And
I want to quickly interject. That does not mean that we are here to promote one particular party over another, for the record. We are not here to promote one particular party. We are just here to present facts.
Correct. Correct. Thank you for that. So Kathy breaks this all down and traces it back to the U.S. News report. Do you remember when you were going to college and you got the you went to the drugstore, you got the big magazine of the U.S. and News World Report, and you flipped through to the kind of college you wanted to go to. So women's colleges for you, liberal arts colleges for me. And you were like, the number one school. Okay, I have to go and visit them. I have to like find out some information on them.
Those Do you remember the memories? And it was like, my school was rated highest for like beauty. Like it was like the best food and like the best dorm rooms. And I was like, that's where I'm going. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, I was concerned about grades and like life after school, of course, but
sure. You know. Yeah. Who wasn't? But we all cared about what that ranking in the U.S. News and World Report was.
Of course.
Right.
Of course.
And like, I mean, my God, we could have a whole different conversation on going to college and like that recruitment stuff. But turns out, Kathy traces back for us in chapter 3 here about how this all happened. And so she traces back through this U.S. news and rankings and how when they first started to come out in the 80s, no one really paid a whole lot of attention to them, and they were just kind of getting reports from various college presidents and whatever, not a big deal. But as they started to do this, they wanted to get people complained at them, and they were like, why weren't we the number one school? So what do they do? How do you make that fair, right? How do you even out the rankings? Well, of course,
why do I have this image of somebody calling somebody up and be like, how did you get this ranking? You know that my school is better than looking and better than your school, and my students are more knowledgeable than your students. Like I just have this image of a bunch of presidents sitting at a table. And if it's the 80s, you know that there's like little to no women sitting at these tables. So
right. And so it's like homecoming queen competition all over again. And they were all trying to out mean girls each other. And so what they do is they're like, hey, U.S. News and World Report, it's not cool that we're not number one on whatever category. So U.S. News and World Report has to figure out some ways to systematize that and to try to make it more understandable what they're doing, right? So they create an algorithm. They create some kind of formula to do this, which seems fine, right? Like in theory, that seems like a pretty harmless thing because You want people to be able to go to the best schools. Great. But turns out the way they did that is they said, okay, what are the best schools? So at that time, what are the best schools that they're looking at? Stanford, Yale, Harvard, Princeton.
Now the Ivies.
Right. And they say, what makes those better schools than other schools? So if we
white men, I don't know.
I mean, yes, but it is legal at this point to put race into their equation, right? So they can't put race into the equation. So what do they do? What percentage of your alumni give money back to your school? What percentage of your alumni are employed 9 months after graduation? What percentage of, you know, whatever. And so they're looking at these various metrics that those schools did particularly well in. This makes sense, right? Like that kind of makes sense, sort of, yeah. But what the result of this is that the schools who aren't doing well say, aha, how do I get to this benchmark? Well, maybe if I put more money into creating a fancy dining room, or maybe if I put more money into landscaping, or maybe if we reject 50% of all applicants just off the cuff, maybe that'll get us the better students, quote unquote. Or maybe if we accept this athlete who maybe is really good at sports, but not so good at English, and we accept this other person who's really good at English, but not so good at sports, it'll even out. And so we'll have a really good student body and we can get to that average we want at the end, right? And so as they start doing this, what happens is they're spending more money on aesthetics, the cost of tuition goes right? And skyrockets. Wow. And so we can draw this direct connection between the U.S. News and World Report and the changes in higher ed. And
wow.
I know. And so O'Neill's conclusion is this is all due to these big data and the formulas that are being driven to do these rankings that maybe aren't valuable, but maybe aren't so valuable, right? But they're pushing the whole system of education. And so we see this in the education system as a whole, but then she also breaks it down how this happens with teacher evaluations, which is something I am acutely aware of, and how people are getting fired because of teaching evaluations, largely in K-12 schools, but this happens in higher ed universities as well. And due to, in part, some Reagan era policies, some George W. Bush policies, No Child Left Behind, and how the Obama administration tried to regulate some of those, but kind of missed the mark, and how it's still really, we're having this product of a lot of presidencies past. And again, I'm not trying to say anything. Clinton also did some really terrible policies on this, frankly, and we'll come back to Clinton in a minute when we get to the criminal system, because she also does some really nice analysis of that. And so she's taking us on this journey and saying, look, all of these evaluations and these teachers who are getting fired, all of these algorithms are literally nonsense. They mean absolutely nothing, because the data being fed into them is based on assumptions, just like the Princeton, Harvard, Yale assumptions of what makes a good school is what makes a good teacher is based on the test scores of the students. But if you have really high performing students at the 99th percentile, one of the ways we test teachers is, well, did your students improve from the August exams or the October exams to the April exams? If they're in the 99th percentile, they can't get any higher than that because they don't do 100th percentile, right? They only go up to 99. So if you have high performers and they start at 99, in April, they're also going to be at 99. There's no improvement. You might get a 3 for that year. But if you had students who were at the 50th percentile in October and they're at the 80th percentile in April, you'll have a 90% rating. And so you'll be able to stay in that school district.
So, yeah, the words that I want to say are not appropriate for right now, but wow. You're there's a no-win situation here.
Right. Right. And so what O'Neill does is she compares this to the algorithms of like Google or Amazon or Apple, right? They all depend on algorithms and big data too. And they want to know, like I was giving you the example of where were you shopping in Target and then giving you online ads for that, because that'll mean revenue for them, right? If they're giving you ads that you're likely to click on, that increases their revenue.
Right.
This makes sense, right? And so they optimize this all the time. But if you go once to the baby aisle and you never go again, they're not going to give you baby ads because you're not going to buy baby stuff, right?
Right.
And so they're constantly putting in new data and saying, okay, we want to optimize this so that these ads are actually getting clicks so that we're getting more money back. This makes enough sense, right? But if we go back to the evaluation criteria of teachers, this formula doesn't have any error basis. So if it doesn't have, if it can't put in, like this is the reason these students didn't improve, so the teacher evaluations couldn't go up, if it's never getting that data back in, it's going to keep using the same formula to the end of time because it thinks it's the right formula. And it can't put in any more data because it's not following students long term. It only has two data points. So if you only have two data points and you have like 30 students, there's no way you can ever change that formula, right? Because it's relying on the philosophy of big data and large numbers, but it can't actually play those out because there isn't enough data to play that out. And there's not the same kind of thing. So it's using the same formulas that Google and Amazon are using, but it's applying them in a way that is not the same. Does that make sense?
It makes a lot of sense. And it's frustrating.
It's so frustrating. You
know, and just thinking that here are, and again, going back to what you were talking about with teachers who are out there, and again, shout out to teachers K through 12 and above, you know, let me say K through 12 and above, you're out there. And I mean, course evaluations at the collegiate level is one thing. And then trying to get students in K through 12 at a point where they need to be, like they should be able to articulate and understand certain things, whether it be math or let it be grammar, what have you. I mean, it just, and I'm lost for words right now, because if the student misses, I don't want to say the student misses the mark, because that's not what I'm saying, but if the algorithm doesn't work, it doesn't work. And then it penalizes the teacher for no reason.
Yeah. And that's exactly what this is showing, right? And this is perhaps not new information to some of you. I've known this more or less since probably 06. I think I wrote a paper in undergrad on this, very phenomenon.
Of course you did, Dr. Lizzie.
I was real salty about standardized tests. I did not like them at that age. And I was real mad about the No Child Left Behind thing at that point in my life. Either which way though, it tells us that this is a formula, right? And it is a flawed formula. So, okay, that might be just enough to say like education has a flawed formula, but it doesn't stop at education, does it?
No.
So
what else does Kathy enlighten us to?
So many things. So I'm not going to go through all of her examples, but I'm going to go through at least two more, and then we'll jump to some conclusions. Sound good?
It sounds good.
Okay. So the next one she really does in depth is the criminal justice system. And yep.
I'm already shaking my head.
Yep. Oh, before actually we leave education, let me do one last point, because this is an important one, that the standards for these evaluation of K to 12 teachers and even higher ed teachers are use these flawed formulas in big schools. But in smaller schools, in private schools, in non-public schools, they don't use these formulas. They go based on recommendations or caregivers or students, and they do other evaluative things because the principal has just maybe 20 teachers to watch over instead of 200 teachers to watch over. And if you have 20, you can know them one-on-one. And if you have 200, you can't. And so you have to rely on the formula.
Wow.
So who is getting most affected by these flawed formulas? The already marginalized.
Right.
Okay. So this is a system.
So the ones that are in the schools with 200 teachers and don't have access to a private education chart. I'm not trying to throw charter schools under the bus for the record, but charter school education, all those types of educations, you know, versus like a public school education. Yeah.
Doesn't that hurt?
That really hurt my soul.
Yep. Yep. I know. I know. And I will say, as a product of a rural schools also, while they are smaller, rely on that public funding just as much as the really urban schools do that have the 200 plus teachers per district. And even though they're smaller, they still have to use those same formulas as the really big schools do because they don't have that private funding. And so it's a similar scenario. So it's a really, really flawed formula. Okay, let's move on to the justice system.
Yay.
So in the justice system, one of the things she breaks down is how we decide whether or not people can be released early from jails and prisons. And one of the formulas they use to determine that is how likely they are to have recidivism. They to end up back in jail or prison. How do we determine that? By a formula, because of course we do.
Of course it's by a formula, right? Thanks, Kathy. Thanks, yep. Kathy.
Yep. Yep, sure is. And the formula, one of the questions is, have you had prior dealings with law enforcement? Who has likely, now that isn't a question about race, but it's absolutely a question about race because who has had more likely to have had dealings, past dealings with law enforcement?
Are you asking me or are you telling me?
I mean, I was going to leave it like hanging there, but I mean, go for it.
I mean, if we're going to go statistically, I mean, we're probably going to say like a Black male.
Yeah.
That's what, wow.
Mm-hmm. Black and Indigenous men and Latinx men or Latino men.
So men of color.
Men of color. Yeah. But also women of color. That's also an increasing demographic for incarceration.
Right.
So that's point one. Point two is how many people do you know who have had dealings with the law and with the legal system? Again, lower income communities and communities of color, much more likely to know other people who are in the system than white communities.
The law enforcement and then the legal. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And if both of those things are true, then you're unlikely to be released early. So, and like, there's other things that go into this, but those are two of the biggest drivers for how those formulas are done. Do people on the inside know that? No. Right? And no one, the legal systems will not release, or the justice system, the incarceration communities will not release the formulas they use for this. The companies who give the recidivism formulas will not release the formulas they use, but you can kind of do some backwards design and like figure out who's been released and who hasn't. And people who have been released will tell you what those questions were that they answered. And so you can kind of do some figuring out. And so that's how some of this data has come to us of why this is such a problem. But it's also a problem not only for that, but also in how policing happens.
Right.
So she breaks down for us how we use, there's a system called PredPol, and it is essentially crime reporting system that will analyze how likely crime is to be in a certain area. Now, you might think to yourself, that seems really useful, right? I want to know if I'm going out in a neighborhood, if I'm likely to have my car robbed, if I'm likely to have my purse snatched, if I'm likely to experience whatever, whatever, whatever. The problem here is it is not just analyzing violent crime. It is not just analyzing more major crimes like car theft. It is also analyzing things like loitering, things like drug use, not like selling, but just use. It's also analyzing things like sex work data and other data that is really, really flawed, right? Not only flawed in like who gets it, but also in terms of like how often those things are being reported and prosecuted and whatever. So it's analyzing all of that. So what does that mean? It's actually just further targeting low-income communities.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And so then if there are more police in those areas, what's going to happen? But there's going to be more crime, quote unquote, in those areas, because of course there is, because anytime police are around, they're going to see more crime, right? Not necessarily because more crime is happening, but because if you're watching an area really closely, you're going to see people doing things that everyone does, right?
Exactly.
I like to give my students the example of how bad of a system having speeding, how we understand speeding in our society is, right?
Right.
And it's always one of my go-to examples for how not to do behavior change, because when do people slow down on the highway? When they see a cop car.
See an officer.
Right. They don't ever do it outside of that, right?
And at the beginning of the month and at the end of the month.
You know, I've slowed down my driving a lot over the years and I rarely speed anymore, but I used to all the time when I was in my early 20s, because that was the culture I grew up in, right? And
well, I mean, and also in Indiana is also a speedy place. I'm just saying, I mean, the Indy 500, my theory is that everybody thinks they're in the Indy 500 in Indiana. I'm just saying.
Yeah. Especially on a couple different highways. Yeah. Yeah. One of my coworkers used to always say, oh, you're out on the racetrack today. And I was like, first time she said that, I was like, no, it's just on the highway. And she was like, yeah, the racetrack. And
the
I was
racetrack.
Like, oh, okay.
Yeah. No, but I mean, this is just, so not only are you penalized as a, and this is what I'm taking away in this moment, mm-hmm. as a child of color,
mm-hmm.
in your education, then you've got a government system but you've got the penal system that's pretty much coming after you at a very early age.
Yep.
If you don't hit certain criteria.
Yep. Yep. Correct. She says on page 87, in our largely segregated cities, geography is a highly effective proxy for race. That feels really, really important.
Can you read that one more time? I'm sorry.
I sure can. In our largely segregated cities, geography is a highly effective proxy for race.
Mm.
Now, let me just read you one more quote. This is on page 90. This is a little bit longer, so stay with me for a second.
Okay.
Just imagine if police enforced their zero tolerance strategy in finance, they would arrest people for even the slightest infraction, whether it was chiseling investors on 401ks, providing misleading guidance, or committing petty frauds. Perhaps SWAT teams would descend on Greenwich, Connecticut. They'd go undercover in taverns in Chicago's Mercantile Exchange. Not likely, of course. The cops don't have the expertise for that kind of work. Everything about their jobs, from their training to their bulletproof vest is adapted to the mean streets. She goes on for a little bit, and I'm going to pick it back up on page 91. The result is that we criminalize poverty, believing mm-hmm. all the while that our tools are not only scientific, but fair.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I didn't realize you heard my sigh.
I did. The result is that we criminalize poverty. Let me say that one more time, because I think that's a really important point. And I think this picture she paints of how we differentiate what kind of crimes we care about, what kind of crimes we police, what it would look like if some people were policed in the way that others were in our society is a really, really important point. And it reinforces this whole outline of all of these formulas that we use to determine how policing happens, what we consider dangerous and what we don't, and how we reinforce this not only in our judicial systems and in our prison systems, in our education systems, but also in our employment systems, which is where we're going to go to next.
You are taking us there today.
Right?
Thank you, Dr. Lizzie. And thank you, Kathy O'Neill.
Yeah. Wow. Seriously. So, before I leave this, I'm going to give you one last little quote from her, because I think this is really important. She says on page 103 and 104, innocent people surrounded by criminals get treated badly, and criminals surrounded by law-abiding people get a pass. Mm-hmm. The rest of us barely have to think about them. And I think this is one of the biggest conclusions from this text, is that these formulas are designed so that the people who experience the disproportionate and the disadvantageous effects of these feel it all the time. And the people mm-hmm. who don't even have to notice it at all. And I think this is part of her conclusion, that these weapons of MATH destruction are destroying society. They are so opaque that people can't really see them, and that they're causing problems in a way in which is further dividing society mm-hmm. and is doing so in a way that we can proclaim is good and is saving money and is leading to the benefit of society, when in fact it is doing the exact opposite. So the employment one, partly she goes through implicit bias with names and such in resumes, which I'm pretty sure most people know at this point, that a Shannon is more likely to get a job than a Shante. But she also talks about how that is not only true for a specific hiring manager, but it is also inputted into certain formulas that screen resumes before they even get to the hiring manager's desks. So if there are like 100 applicants for one position, you're not reviewing 100 applications. And so now there are these formulas, these computers that will set up to give you the like 10 best ones, mm-hmm. but it's not actually a human on the other end of that is reviewing all of those with whatever kind of salary that they have. It's $1,000 computer program that reviews them quickly and then gives you the top candidates. But the ways that that happens is bad inputs, right? And it is the assumptions that whoever was designing that code had that are typically implicitly racist and classist. This isn't, go ahead.
No, it just reminds me of a time where I wanted to, instead of going by my full name, which I do professionally, I was going to go by TM Quash to like level the playing field for myself, because I was like, you know, Tiffany, it could go either way, you know, Quash, it probably leans more black than white, but it could, you know, you never know. So I was going to go like, let me go by TM Quash, because then you don't really know, and you don't know gender. You don't know. You just don't know. But yeah, you're just saying so much right now that resonates with me. I never actually applied for a job like that, but I definitely thought about it several times, and I had friends that talked me out of it because they were like, why are you doing this to yourself? And I'm like, I want to give myself the best chance, you know? So.
Yeah. Well, and that's just it, right? And it's how do you know how to navigate that as an individual, but also how do we change that as a system, right? And I think both need to be addressed simultaneously, and it makes it so, so challenging for the people who know they're disproportionately impacted by that. So
She
breaks down that it's not just getting a job, but it's also how you maintain it. And hours are set by algorithms as well for a lot of big box stores right now and big companies. So Starbucks has this big mantra, and I'm going to pick on them specifically because I'm in Buffalo and there's been a lot of kerfuffle with Starbucks lately in the last year. Anyway, if you know it, you know it. If you don't, that's fine. So Starbucks has this big company policy that says we'll give employees at least a week's notice of what their schedule will be like for the next week. However, the algorithms will decide 72 hours in advance, oh, there's a storm coming in, so people are likely to do a bunch of shopping from this window to this window. So then they'll schedule people in 72 hours before. Now that might be fine, but if you are somebody who has to arrange childcare, 72 hours is not a long enough window. Time. No, mm-hmm. No. And for most people who are working in those jobs, maybe they have low income or low education. Maybe that's the only job they can get. Maybe they don't have a partner. Maybe they do, but it's really,
maybe
really
they don't
hard.
Have somebody they can put the child on, and they don't have that type of community, period.
Exactly. And if you can't do that, then you're not working. And if you're not working, then that cycle is even worse for you, right? Because you're trying to figure out how else to get a job. But if that's the only kind of job you can get, then what are you doing, right? You have to figure it out. And so it becomes increasingly stressful and hard to manage and navigate as you try to balance childcare with work. And particularly given the high cost of childcare, right? You might have to be working all of those hours to be able to pay for childcare. These systems also ensure that you're not working more than 35 hours, so you're not ever getting qualified for health insurance, which is a really big problem as well. Wow. So this becomes really tricky. A lot of these companies also use a big five personality test and with employment, which means they're violating the ADA.
Can I just say for the record, I did not get a job at Starbucks because I had to take that personality test. I will let that go eventually.
Eventually. At some
point. Pre-employment. I mean, you know what I'm talking about. Dr. Lizzie, do you know what I'm talking about? It's like this personality thing.
I do.
Thank you. Okay. I'm sorry. I don't mean to take the J out of the joy. See, thank you, Kathy. Please explain it to me, Kathy, because I am very bitter. I am very bitter. Why can't I be on my lone island? Like, what is so wrong?
So nothing is wrong. The problem is even the people who have designed this will not be able to fully answer how they designed it or why the test will reject some people or will say other people are good to hire. They don't fully understand it. It is not 100% clear. The companies will all say no one question will bar you from employment. However, some questions, the way you answer them will give a red flag. And if you have a red flag, you're unlikely to be called for an interview or you're unlikely to be hired.
Well, I guess I was just a cute red flag at least. Wow. Wow. Uh-huh. I mean, to me, it would show like, okay, dependability, you know? I'm dependable. I am somebody who, if you put me on that island by myself, that I can survive.
Correct. But the thing is,
can we send this book to everybody that I apply to other place? Just
saying. Well, right. And the problem is, as she says, is like, you're stuck if no matter what you answer, because you don't know what they're looking for. There's no rhyme or reason for why they're screening you the way that you are. And so you don't know how to answer most of the questions, because most of the questions are not like, are you a hard worker? Yes or no. They're like, would you get angry if people were complaining at you in line? And it's like, and the options are either yes all the time or yes some of the time. And it's like, well, I don't know what to put there. Like, probably some of the time.
I would be very angry if somebody was yelling at me.
Well, right. Who wouldn't? But like, also, what does that even mean? And what does angry mean? Because what I think angry means might be very different than what you think angry means.
Thank you. Yes. Right.
Because how do we construct the world, Tocly?
Huh? Oh, as a chair, we are both on it today. We are both like, a chair is not a chair, or maybe a chair. Yes, we're going back to our roots, our qualitative roots. Our chair may not be a chair. Yes.
Yes.
All the way back to episode one. Yes.
If you haven't listened to that episode, listeners, please do. It's a gem. As I recall, I haven't re-listened to it, but I'm sure it's a gem. I remember it being a gem.
It's a gem because we were there.
That's right. Yeah. So she also goes through some examples, and I'm not going to go into all of these, but of credit and how credit is used, how credit formulas are used, how health insurance is used, how voting and campaign advertisements are used. All of these are big data formulas, and all of that is driven by these big data formulas. And so at this point, she jumps into conclusion and talks about that it would be great if we could get rid of these big data formulas, right? That sounds lovely. However, even if we could get rid of them in education, the problem is that the formulas that they use in education have already fed into the formulas used for voting, have already fed into the formulas used for the judicial system, have already fed in to the ways the formulas that are used for how we're being advertised to. So all of these are feeding into each other. So we can't just pull one out because they're all using each other and they've already existed. And so it's almost impossible at this point in our society to just pull out these formulas and the big data and all of the flaws in them, which, you know, is truly a depressing thought, honestly.
Just a little.
Just a smidgey. Okay. So I want to read this because I think it's a lovely, lovely quote. But I'm actually going to give it to you to read. So page 200, start us off on the, are you at page 200? Okay. The second paragraph, our national motto.
Our national motto, E Pluribus Unum, means out of many, one, but WMDS, or weapons of mass destruction, reverse the equation. Working in darkness, they carve one into many, while hiding us from the harms they inflict upon our neighbors near and far.
Thank you. So I love this. I think this is just a nice example of how brilliantly O'Neill writes and like how lovely this ties together for us of this reversal of this tenet of American ideology. We were probably all taught this out of many one idea at some point in our childhood, or in my case, many. I cannot tell you how many times we were shouted that at, and like as children, like, mur, 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 get along with each other.
That'll be my next tattoo. Out of many one.
Right. And yet this idea of these MATH, weapons of MATH destruction, are that it's the reverse. It's out of one many. And it's this, we're going to collapse all of this data, use all of this giant data to change, to say like, here's how we can understand people, and we can understand people in this problematic way or this problematic way, right? And I think this is where I really wanted to spend some time actually chatting back and forth. And like, as we're wrapping up our discussion of this book, she says, one of the ways we can solve this is through research. So we can use research to kind of poke holes in this and to say, okay, if we can't get rid of these math formulas altogether and this big data altogether, we can at least use research to poke holes in it and to say, this is the problem with these formulas and it's causing all of these problems. We can also have conversations about it and educate people about it. We can also try to think about other ways of having data. Hey, maybe this podcast will help you understand how to have other ways of having data. But I think there's no type of research that is without flaw. There's no type of research or information that cannot be used by somebody from a different ideology as yourself. But if we don't talk about those problems, we allow them to perpetuate and to be reinforced. And so as I was kind of thinking about the biggest pieces of this, these formulas are going to hurt our most marginalized communities more. These formulas, we like to say that they are free of bias because remember back to our last episode, listeners, of positionality. And we talked about the fact that a lot of people think quant is free of bias. And what O'Neill does so brilliantly in this book is say, actually, these formulas are reinforcing bias, but we're pretending that they remove bias because we're saying, look, none of these things within the judicial system ask about race because it's illegal to do so, but they're asking about race because they're using other things as a proxy for it. The job employment applications with personality isn't asking about intelligence, which is illegal, but it's absolutely violating the ADA, but people who are most hurt by this, who are most vulnerable to this, are not being able to push back because the employers are saying, well, we're not asking about intelligence, so it can't be wrong. Mm-hmm. And it's like, this is a way to reinforce the human stereotypes and the human problems and imply them to the most vulnerable in our society.
Mm-hmm. You took us there. Kathy took us there. Wow. I'm sitting with everything that you just said because it reminds me again, I probably was one of those red flags because it was like, you know, like, oh, well, she can't be a team player. I'm like, listen, I can be a team player. I just happened to play sports where it's individual sports all my life. You know, like swimming, tennis, like those are individual sports, you know, you depend upon yourself. I feel like I'm defending myself in this moment, but, but I mean, it's kind of like, if somebody were to ask me that question, hey, are you going to get mad if somebody's yelling at you while you're standing in the Starbucks line? you know, and you're behind the counter, I'm like, yes, yeah, yes, I will get mad. I will do my best to push whatever down, but I could very well get upset because my feelings are hurt. I'm a human.
And isn't that a beautiful thing?
It is a beautiful thing. I mean, not all of us can be emotionless, you know. We just can't be emotionless. I don't get it. It's really interesting how you took us through, like, how Kathy takes us through education and then the judicial system and then, you know, just employment. These are things that you need in life in order to succeed.
Go ahead. They are. And I think that's part of why I wanted to ask you at the beginning, what is the biggest problem in American society, right? Because I've spent the entire last semester, I was teaching social determinants of health. And every week I would ask my students, okay, let's talk. We would talk about race, and then we would talk about gender, and then we would talk about sexual identity, and then we would talk about class, and then we would talk about geography, and right, and we would go on this journey every week of talking about these different problems in our society and how they impact our health. Mm-hmm. And every week I would say to them, how much is a life worth, and whose life is worth more? Because
how much is a life worth, and whose life is worth more? Wow. And what were your students' responses?
Well, mostly I would leave them that with that every week, but I would say, okay. Right? Like, it was kind of my ending question, because as we were going on this journey, and then they would write me reflections and they would be like, oh, I'm thinking about this thing in a whole different way because of what we talked about in class, or, oh, I'm understanding how race is connected to class, is connected to gender, is connected to incarceration, is connected to food deserts, is connected to redlining, is connected to environmental toxins, is connected to, right? And so, like, they're making this web in their mind of how all of these are connected. And I would say at the end of the day, public health is all about protecting the health of the most vulnerable, but we have to understand who that is and how that is. These systems are reinforcing themselves, right?
Yeah.
And I think the conclusion for me has always been, well, we don't care about certain people in our society, and we have set up our society to tell people that. Kathy's conclusion is, it's due to the math formulas and the big data. And that is reinforcing those human stereotypes that we have had for years. And I think that's such an important conclusion to draw on. And I think how it connects us back to this is, where do we sit with research, and how do we conceptualize research, and how do we do the most good? How do we change society from what it is to what we want it to be? Sorry.
I almost want to say, no, it's okay. I almost want to say, like, how can we be even better researchers? How can we almost, like, when we go into the field, how can we leave the field as good, if not better, than when we left it?
Than when we came.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it just, you know, as researchers, I feel like sometimes we go in and we destroy it. You know, we don't really care. And I think we need to change that. You know, there needs to be a sense of caring going on, love, like being genuine when you go in and when you leave, you know.
That's right.
So, yeah. Wow. Dr. Lizzie, thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. You're welcome.
Thank you, Kathy O'Neill.
Yes. Thank you, Kathy O'Neill. This is a great book. It was a great thinker.
Wow. Well, listeners, we appreciate you joining us on this amazing journey with myself, Dr. Tiffany, and
Dr. Lizzie.
We can't wait to have you back. And until next time, cheers.
Cheers. This has been Coloring Outside the Memos, brought to you by your hosts, Dr. Lizzie Bartelt and Dr. Tiffany Monique Quash. Our editor, website designer, and producer is Lindsay Studer. Our graphic designers are Gas Dellister and Teddy Gabrielli. Our transcripts were edited by Shada Bezargani, and this podcast is supported by American University Center for Teaching, Research, and Learning. And finally, thank you, listeners, for listening. We couldn't do it without you. See you next episode.